Okay. So, I do have one additional request, and that is, when I'm talking and really interested in us having a sort of a robust discussion, for those of you who are not too uncomfortable to do so, it would be great if I could see your faces. Just so I know I'm talking to something other than, the Matrix. So, for those of you who are willing to go ahead and share video with me, I'd appreciate it. Really, actually, is helpful to me insofar as my teaching is concerned. So, thanks for that. Well, as those of you who've been sitting with me for a while know, one of the icons of Buddha Dharma practice and teaching that I turn to and most often or very often rely upon is that of the Dharma chakra or Dharma wheel. And it's actually a religious figure that predates Buddhism. It's like if you go to a Hare Krishna temple, like the one on 14th Avenue here in Denver, you'll see it up on top of their temple there. It usually has flames around it, something, having to do with transcendent wisdom. So the Buddhists kind of appropriated it a little bit, but it is a really handy way to understand the integrated nature of the Buddha's teachings on the Eightfold Path, or the cessation of suffering, how one goes about awakening. So that's where I actually like to start tonight, so I can kind of tie in the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness with the greater scheme of things. There's lots of different ways I've seen this depicted in terms of which spokes of the wheel are associated with different of aspects of the path. Things to remember about the use of the Dharma chakra. First off, that the importance of it as a wheel, which is to say, some of the features that make a wheel useful are the fact that each spoke in the wheel needs to be of relatively the same strength as every other one. Okay. Or it can't keep its shape. It can't be useful. Okay. Another is that it has both an outer and an inner rim. So the hub is what we might think of as the inner life, where all of these qualities meet in the mind as the mind is becoming more aware, is becoming more attuned to its own functioning, and is becoming more insightful into where suffering comes from and how it can bring it to an end. In the very earliest depictions of the Dharma wheel, in the foundation carvings in Malada University, also, the hub itself is empty. So there are all these qualities of mindfulness that lead to freedom, but the freedom also lies in the void and the emptiness of freedom from self, actually. Okay. So let's think of the Dharma wheel as if it were like a compass rose. So if you think about south, southeast, and southwest, those three spokes of the wheel, those are the meditative factors, the factors of concentration, of effort, and a mindfulness, the practice that we're taking up a careful study of this month. What the cultivation of those meditative factors does, okay, working in conjunction with each other, is to make it possible for the mind to become clear enough, steady enough, focused enough, non-reactive enough, to be able to then undertake insight practice. Okay. Insight into what? Insight into our karma. Okay. So think about due west and northwest. Okay, those two spokes referred to by the Buddha as the wisdom factors. The mind needs to be grounded, steady, and clear through the meditative factors in order for it to become possible for insights to begin to arise. What happens when the mind has become steady and calm is that insights begin to spontaneously arise in the mind. And these insights, by and large, have to do with our suddenly realizing, awakening to, recognizing cause-effect relationships between either things that happened to us or things that we did in the past that give rise to who we are in the present. So, if, for instance, we're experiencing some feeling of guilt or regret or shame or something in the moment, then if we simply meditate on that feeling, where it might be coming from, what begins to arise when the mind is clear and non-reactive is just like, aha, okay, right. This event where I said or did something that in retrospect was unwholesome, unskillful, caused harm. It becomes clear that that's what happened. It becomes clear that that's why we're feeling the way that we are in the moment. Okay. And it's like looking kind of down, like looking down a long hallway or looking into a tunnel, looking into our own past, and are able to begin to see all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are in this moment in time, and that gave rise to who our parents were, and their parents, and their parents, and the society that we live in. Okay. And out of that, we start to get a kind of a sense of who we are, not just from having a name and a social security number and an address and, you know, a job or retirement benefits or whatever, but who we are in a very kind of deep sense. Especially our ability to see when I thought, spoke, acted in this way, there is an unwholesome result. When I thought and spoke and acted in that way, there was a wholesome outcome or a wholesome result or a cessation of suffering that occurred. The more we are able to practice that process of simply looking deeply into our past in a non-aversive and accepting way, right? To that same extent, we then become able to, that's the wisdom factor that's usually thought of as sort of right view or right understanding. And based on that, then we're able to gain insight not only to all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are at this moment in time, but the causes and conditions that may or may not give rise to who we're going to be in the next moment, depending on what we think and say and do. Okay. So it's insight into intention. That's the other wisdom factor. When all these, the capacity for all these insights are there, and you're thinking about saying or doing a certain thing, okay, if you can remember back, and this is where the power of insight comes in, if you can remember, okay, the last time I said or did something like that, this was the outcome, right? Especially if you're contemplating saying or doing something that's not based on wholesome intention. One of the things that people sometimes have mixed feelings about when they learn to do insight practice is that we get more and more sensitized to, we begin to experience like real pain when there's something that you really want to say to get it off your chest. But you know that if you do, it's going to have a bad outcome. And it's going to be bad for you and it's going to be bad for others. And so you don't do it, right? That's where the freedom lies. It's insight into both wholesome and unwholesome intentions and learning how not to act on the unwholesome ones. Okay. You have to have cultivated the insights necessary to be able to see deeply enough into your intentions to not act on them if they're not wholesome. Okay. So the two wisdom factors and the three fruition factors of speech, of action, and of way of life. Okay. Speech and action that follows repetitive patterns, said the Buddha, eventually hardens into the kind of the ruts or the tracks that the mind moves along, okay, and becomes a way of life, becomes the nature of the mind. So that's the circle. Get back down to the three meditative factors, cultivating, marshaling the effort to sit down and sit, okay. And then having done so, the mind begins to become a little calm and clear and collected, concentrated mind. And then that creates conditions favorable for mindfulness to arise. And the mindfulness having arisen then, of course, makes possible the insight practice. So what is this mindfulness consist of? And the Buddha said it has... there are four realms or dimensions of mind that are particularly important to pay attention to. So this first foundation of the first establishing of mindfulness is simply mindfulness of breathing in the body. That's the one that we were working on this evening. Just what does it feel like to be in the body? So we can, you know, in slang to say, well, you know, I seem to spend my whole life in my head. Yeah. And so the Buddha clearly recognized, so did he, you know, that was one of the things he realized was really plaguing him, that he was so caught up in the functions of mind that he had lost touch with his body. And so he realized that in order for us to be able to really restore some sense of balance and connectedness to make possible the cessation of suffering, it was important first to just re-inhabit the body in a really complete way. So turn the attention toward what it literally feels like to be in the body. Because if you're really, really grounded in what it feels like to be in this body, in that moment, the mind is not skipping ahead. It's not planning. It's not what ifing. It's not fretting. It's not worrying. It's just in the body in the moment. So it's a kind of a grounding experience. And one of the reasons the Buddha thought it was so helpful is because, and it was just as true in his time as it is now, that when we live in our heads, that tends to be kind of a lonely place. It's through mental activity that we create this sense of separation, being cut off from nature, being cut off from each other. Okay. Sense of isolation. And out of that comes a feeling of fear or anxiety, which is one of the sources of dukkha. Right? And so one of the ways around that is to just fully inhabit the body. Mindfulness of body and breathing. The second foundation of mindfulness, one way to understand it or to put it, and we'll be focusing more on this next week, is one useful way to think about it is, or to phrase it, is mindfulness of reactivity. It's the really unhelpful 19th century translation of the Pali is like mindfulness of feelings, but that connotes emotions, and that's not at all what the second foundation of mindfulness is about. Second foundation is about observing the mind's tendency to immediately react to any stimulus as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Okay. That function of mind, neuroscientists telling us now, comes from a very primitive part of the brain, the medulla oblongata, which is what is in neuroscience circles is called the reptilian brain. It's a very, very, very ancient structure that we share with, you know, just about everybody else in the animal kingdom. But that's all it does. It just judges things to be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So we're going to have a harder look at how that functions and why next week. Third foundation of mindfulness is essentially mindfulness of thoughts and emotions. What in Mahayana they call the alaya or seed consciousness, where memories are stored, where when we get experience a stimulus in the present moment, it's where the mind goes, you know, going through the databases, going through all the memory banks, trying to give whatever that stimulus is meaning, identify it for what it is, whether we like it, don't like it, or neutral. So it's basically the sankharas. It's calling forth our history and applying it to the experience of stimulus response in the present moment. Third foundation. Fourth foundation is mindfulness of dhammas. And it's that fourth foundation that I actually just got through touching on with our little hike around the Dharma chakra, right? Where it all fits in. Okay. So we do mindfulness practice in order to get the mind clear, in order to take in the world in a non-reactive way, so we can experience it fully, and then thereby create conditions favorable for insight into our past, insight into our future, that then creates favorable conditions for skillful speech and action and way of life, and then come around again. And so it's like if you going around and around the Dharma chakra, it's a little bit like each trip around, if you pull it apart a little bit, it's like a double helix, you know? It's like each time you come around, you come around to the same place, except not really, because what you've done is to, get the mind calm and clear, gain insights into your past, insights into your future, experience the consequences of skillful and unskillful behavior. And then you bring all that experience, all of that, the insights, the intentions, the actions, you bring that once again to bear on meditation. And each time around, it gets a little more refined. So we're bringing the insights, we're bringing the history of skillful and unskillful conduct back to bear on the practice of mindfulness once again. My friend, fellow teacher, Lee Brazington, wrote an article once called Sharpening Manjushri's Sword, and by that he meant each time we go around the circle, right? Get meditation well established, insights arise, insights into the past, insights into intentions, speech, action. And then when we come back into the realm of meditation again, the mindfulness is sharper and clearer because we have a better understanding and appreciation for why we're doing it in the first place. If you have only these wisdom factors, it's quite cerebral. It's just mental activity. You really do need to be grounded in the body, so you can remember that it is the entirety of the body. And there's a book about the embodiment of trauma called The Body Keeps the Score. It's basically how the body remembers at a very deep level anything traumatic that may have happened to it, and those memories are stored in the body. They're always going to be with you to some extent or the other. So, round and round we go. So that's a little bit about how the practice of mindfulness fits into this greater scheme of eventually freeing the mind. It kind of forms one of the foundations, I kind of hate to use the terms having to do with edifice or stability, because it's not a solid thing. It's an ongoing process, right? But the process continues to get more and more and more refined as we do it with a certain element of constancy. There's the framework. I would really love to discuss that, share any views that you might have, any questions you might have, how all this fits together. Where things look backward in the mirror, so please, questions or thoughts, and unmute if you wish.
Hello?
Yeah. Are you the little green? I think you're the little phone button down in the lower right. What's your name?
This is Julia.
Hi, Julia.
Hi. I have a question. Unless somebody was going first, I can't see.
No. Please.
Okay. It seems to me that number one and number two mindfulnesses, number one kind of leads into number two, or blends into it. It's a natural progression, so to speak. I mean, it's hard to find, it was hard for me to find, differentiation there between the two. Or is that true of all four of them?
Yeah, no, when they all kind of support and relate to each other. One of the things that we'll have a closer look at when we get together next week, when we'll be looking at the sort of the reactive nature of mind, is that whenever we experience a bodily sensation For instance, the smell of a rose is different than putting your hand on a hot stove, right? We tend to judge one to be pleasant, the other to be unpleasant. So it's the raw data that comes in through the senses when we're just paying attention to the body. One of the things that we notice when we're looking at, at the mind's reactive nature is that it's all of the time processing, this sensory inputs, is this beneficial? Is this harmful? Is this neither? But it's this kind of ongoing process. The one of the things that is, and we'll really be exploring this in more depth next time, is the use of the second foundation of mindfulness to disaggregate pain. And for that matter, to disaggregate not only physical pain, but mental affliction as well. Cool. How do we characterize it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So continue.
Oh, one other quick question.
Yep.
It seems to me that there's a possibility that self-delusion would be rife, the possibility of delusion is rife throughout all four of these.
You got it. Only do I say it, the Buddha said it. He said, all of our wholesome and unwholesome karma, is all traceable back, is all rooted in three, or unwholesome karma, all of our suffering is all traceable back to what he called three unwholesome roots. And that is the mind's tendency to grasp or to cling in a craving way to what we want, to push away with anger or aversion things that we don't like,
right,
and then to ignore everything else, including ignoring the extent to which the mind is caught up in craving and aversion, right?
That's right. That's the center of the Lord of Death, Yama. It's holding it in its maw all of life, and that's at the very center. But, number four sounds kind of groovy in a way about you come back better and sharper each time, but I don't want to be coming back again and again, and I don't know. it's like it's not any better than number one or two, I think.
Well, right. Dispelling delusion is an awful lot of what the Dharma is all about. Jesus of Nazareth said, "You must be born again." It's like the Buddha said, "You must be born again and again and again and again."
I want to go. I'm going to go back to the Catholic Church and go to heaven and stay there.
Okay, there you go. Sounds a lot simpler.
Okay, bye.
All you gotta do is turn over the controls to somebody else, right?
Bye. I might hang up now.
This is definitely do it yourself, Dharma. No two ways.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, no, there's no easy way. Yes.
Appreciate you.
Thank
speaking
you very
up.
Much. I'm joking, of course.
Okay. And yeah, right. So please, others. Yeah, please, Larry.
Jim?
Hi, Tara.
Hi.
Larry from Boulder. Hey, is the mindfulness just a disillusionment, a process of just clearing the mind and not actually venting in eventual samadhi after 1,000 years or 2 years or what?
What mindfulness does in my experience, and as the Buddha taught it, was to radically expand the field within which we view ourselves and all phenomena. So for instance, through doing this practice a long time, I have I've come to personal appreciation of the mutually reinforcing relationship between alcohol abuse and depression, right? And at one point in my life, I became aware that I was really kind of dying from within, uh-huh. You know, that being kind of dragged down made less fully alive by these afflictions. And at times it would feel like they really kind of had the best of me. And I was on a downbound train, like, you know, the boss used to say, when the mindfulness is strong, what happens is, like I was saying earlier, it's possible to all of a sudden, wow, it's within this great space to see my karma and all this, you know, that in fact there is a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. I got a long line of drunks in my family on both sides, that there is a genetic predisposition to, you know, to anxiety and depression. You know, for some people, you know, not always, but sometimes for me, it feels like my default option, right? The difficulty with those afflictive emotions arises when we bring aversion to those afflictive emotions to the picture.
Okay,
it's what the Buddha called the second dart. And we become focused on trying to make them go away, and we can't. Mindfulness relaxes the field and opens things up so I can say, aha, okay, well, there's that genetic predisposition. There's the tendency toward, you know, anxiety and depression. And this has been my experience over and over and over again. I'm sure it is for a lot of you as well at the same time. The mind literally cannot do both things at once.
Right.
In other words, I find myself sometimes getting, you know, kind of sucked in and kind of feel sorry for myself. And, you know, sometimes, especially in the fall, there'll be days when it feels like my default option is kind of sadness, or, you know, it's like, oh, damn, you know, it looks like we're going to have another winter. but then suddenly when mindfulness is present, it's like all of a sudden, oh, there's sadness, or there's anxiety, there's depression, there's craving. But I can see that they're not me. They're just phenomena that are arising in the field. And so earlier, this evening when I was talking about making peace with yourself, that's what I was referring to. Mm-hmm. And that only becomes possible when the mindfulness is present and strong. It's like, you know, you literally can't do both things at once. When you're being mindful of something like feeling down or whatever, essentially what's happening is that we're being mindful of how we felt in the previous moment, right? And we might feel that way in the next moment or not, right? But what the mindfulness does, it creates this, like I said, a big field and this real interesting space between the experience of the afflictive emotion, you know, and the seeing of the experience of the emotion.
Right.
And it's enormously freeing when that becomes possible.
So when you're talking about freeing, are you talking about being present moment? And if you've had many years of meditation, do you experience more levels of joyousness, as well as recognizing the things you're describing?
more get more experience of what did you say?
Joyousness.
Joy, happiness.
Happiness, bliss.
Yeah. I experience those mostly, well, sometimes spontaneously, mostly when I'm doing deep samadhi practice, the jhanas. When the mindfulness is strong, I'd say, yeah, there is a sense of just freedom, you know? And so, yeah, there's usually for me, it's not usually very effervescent or, you know, ebullient, but there is just this calm acceptance, and that's freeing, and that's nice.
Do you feel like that since you've been meditating probably most of your life, it happens more often than not in your experience?
When Terry Ray, she talked about being on a retreat once with a teacher, and at the end of the retreat, you know, they're giving a going home talk, and somebody asked the teacher, well, how much should I meditate? And she said, well, it depends on how happy you want to be.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. The more you practice, the more those moments become apparent. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good questions. Thank you, Larry. Dorothy.
Yes. This is just something I read, either a tricycle or a lion's roar. I don't know. And it has to do with mindfulness of breathing in the body. It's not very esoteric. It's just a practical suggestion that was given. And I find it very helpful to settle into the breathing.
Okay.
And what the suggestion was, and sometimes I do count my breaths.
Yes.
But this one said, when you start out, count the in-breath one, out-breath one. In breath two and go to 10. Then go back and start with just the in breath. So your focus is on counting the in breath. Mm-hmm. One in breath and then out. Two, and then you go to 10. And then the third time, of course, you focus on the out breath. And for me, it just after doing all that, it's very settling. And then I could just be with the breath. It's just very helpful. So, Good. Yeah. Anyway, for what it's worth.
Yeah, thank you. I'd say whatever you find useful insofar as calming the mind, drawing you in, or, you know, there are a lot of ways to, skillful ways to work with the breathing, and that's one of them. One of the things that I also do is just become very conscious. You know, usually when we're doing rigor insight practice, when we're not, you know, specifically training ourselves in mindfulness, is just to watch the breathing, however it happens to be. But in fact, when I'm really interested in settling the mind to a pretty deep place in terms of watching the breathing, it's not, I actually am more purposive about it. And so what I'll do is to deliberately take a pretty long, slow in-breath and then hold it for a little while, and then a long, slow out-breath. And so slow, fairly deep belly breathing, and with conscious attention to a pause at the end of the in-breath and the end of the out-breath. when we get to looking at the at the reactive nature of the mind next week, you know, the if it's called Vedana, one of the things we'll learn in a skillful way to use the breathing when you're feeling anxious or fearful is to do what I just described. And we can actually work with that a little bit more. Because what happens when the mind becomes anxious or fearful is that the breathing becomes shallow and rapid. And then when that happens, the mind begins to become deprived of oxygen, the brain does, which makes you more anxious. And so it begins to become reinforcing. And so doing that very deliberate, slow, deep belly breathing slices right through that, chain reaction, and brings you back into body and can actually dispel fear and anxiety. Yeah, good. Thank you. Appreciate your sharing that. There's stuff coming up. Anyone would like to share either a question or an experience? Jim, and then Paul. Can unmute, Jim?
Yeah, that probably works better if I open my mic.
Yeah, my telepathy is not what it used to be.
Nor is my, you know, whatever it is from my end. Today was a ecumenical Sunday for our 1030 Catholic community and the Capitol Heights Presbyterian folks. And at the end of the service, and the service is really good, and I could talk about that even at a different venue, but and Mark Meeks is the pastor there, and he has a gift for preaching. Anyway, at the end, we blessed a garden, and part of the blessing was to recognize whose land it was on. Mm-hmm. And then, I thought about that in terms of being a social and political advocate for sustainable living and for environmental justice, and you and I share some of those crucial values. So I'm wondering, where does this particular practice intersect with us and sustain us as we try to do this difficult work, maybe with a smile on our face, if possible?
For me, one of the most useful aspects of the practice that we do as far as social or environmental justice work is concerned, as we, you know, do our laps around the Dharma chakra, alights on the question of intention, which is to say, what is the quality of mind that I'm bringing to this work?
Okay.
And especially when I was, you know, negotiating the settlement of the I-70 lawsuit on behalf of Sierra Club, it was so easy to get all up and righteous and, you know, you're just full of it. and to some extent, there can be something to be said for bringing a little bit of that fierceness to play and doing something like, you know, settling a $500,000 lawsuit. But then later on, I could see that in some ways, when I would get all righteous and mouthy about things, it actually wound up making the negotiations more difficult than they had to be.
Yeah.
That if there was a steady focus on the long game and what this was all really about and what we really want out of the deal, that it was in fact was possible to use the practice effectively. And in doing this work, there is a woman who was a part of our Sangha for many years, who used to be a criminal defense attorney. and she just hated going to court. She's good at it, but she didn't like it. And I was, it was, and she said one of the things that was transformative for her in terms of the practice was that she became really got into, got down with metta practice, loving kindness practice. And she said she'd started to experiment with when she would go into the courtroom, you know, she would send metta to her client and she would send metta to the jurors and she would send metta to the judge. And she finally got to the point where she could send metta to the prosecutor.
Now that's and, that's a pretty tough road to hoe with an adversarial legal system.
Absolutely. But she said, when I was able to do that, especially you know, with regard to the prosecutor and what they're trying to do to her client, whatnot. Since I came to the point where I could see them as rivals or adversaries, but not as enemies. Mm-hmm. And I, and in doing, yeah, in doing the justice work and whatnot, the better insight we have into our own motives and our own intentions, the better insight we can have into the others. And then it provides an opportunity to bring the practice to play to the extent we can do it.
Yeah. Well, that's helpful. And just briefly, I keep telling my friends, eventually they're going to have to close the I-70 because of public health issues. And they're going to have to run that traffic over 270 and I-76. And there are still people fighting hard again, to put the truth out, to say, here are the public health issues with children and the schools, et cetera. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that, but I agree with you. It's a long haul kind of thing.
Indeed, right. And it may well extend beyond our lifetime. You know, same thing with turning around the climate crisis.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to last way, way beyond our time. Paul, please.
We're planting acorns.
When you're referring to our meditation practice and breathing exercises, one of the things that I remember is that the connection between the mind and the breath is very, very strong and very real in that, as you were saying, as we calm the breath, there's some physiological things that are happening in the brain that leads us to a better understanding of what's happening. And the slower breathing is part of that. And it's being aware, for me, being aware of how close my breathing is to my mindset is very, very helpful.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate your underscoring that. I think conscious, deep, slow breathing, you know, is something that has become increasingly important to me over the years, as far as being able to quickly establish some degree of mindfulness. And, you know, one way to think about this entire practice, in fact, is our ability to gradually relax the mind to ever deeper levels of calm and peace. You know, first to learn to take it all in a spacious way without being reactive. And then as we get to the looking at the fourth foundation of mindfulness, it really does become possible to calm the mind to the point where it no longer feels it necessary to conjure the self. You know, that's a deep state of relaxation, and it becomes possible through doing mindfulness meditation. Yeah. Sometimes. But it is possible to do, you know. So just calming and settling in, being with things as they are, whether we like them or not, just being with them in a non-reactive way. It's a huge, huge piece of this, actually. Learning to not do. When I was doing research on sacred sites on public lands for that book that I wrote on the subject, there is one of the contested sites is a site that the Northern Plains tribes called Bear's Lodge, but that the Park Service or Teddy Roosevelt called the Devil's Tower. And so there is an effort to get the rock climbers to not climb the tower during the month of June, because that's when the Northern Plains tribes would gather there for, you know, their spring sacred rites, you know. And I was interviewing a rock climber there, and he said, well, you know, one of the hardest things that I ever learned to do was to climb these 600 foot vertical cracks in Devil's Tower. And he said, second hardest thing was to learn not to climb them. Forego the rush, you know, just let it be. So not climbing, this is another way to think about it. Okay, good. Thank you. Anything else? Any other comments? Questions? Very well. That being the case, let's settle back into our sitting posture. And I'll look forward to seeing y'all here next week. So getting back into our posture, allowing the eyes to gently close, the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Bhavatu sava mangalam rakantu sava devata. May there be every blessing and may all the devas protect you. Sāva Buddha Nubhavena Sāla Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sāva Mangalam Rakantu Sāva Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the Devas protect you. Sāva dhamma nubhavena sādha soti bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavatu sāva mangalam rakantu sāva devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sada Soti Bhavantute. By the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the Devas protect you. Have a good week, everybody. See you.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tara.
Thank you.
Tara Lloyd, what do you want to title this talk?
Karma and the First Foundation of Mindfulness.
Okay, thank you.